Hi everyone, it's Chris Deasy here, and welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. Johanna Stiebert is my guest this week. Johanna is Professor of Biblical Hebrew at the University of Leeds. Now, the interview took place against the backdrop of COVID-19. Johanna explains why she has revamped her modules. And the other big event at the time was the US presidential election. Now, at the time, we didn't know the outcome. The election had taken place, but we didn't know who the winner was going to be. And Johanna talks about her experience of living and teaching in Tennessee, in the buckle of the Bible Belt, and how she didn't predict the result of the election. Johanna has one parent from New Zealand, the other from Germany, and her grandfathers fought on opposite sides during the Second World War. She was born in New Zealand and grew up in Germany. And we learned that Johanna went to Cambridge to do a two-year degree in Biblical Hebrew, and then moved to Glasgow, which she explains was the best place next to heaven. She taught English in Botswana, which was a life-affirming experience, and was there at the height of the HIV/AIDS pandemic. Johanna talks about how she then moved to Knoxville and how a shooting at a Unitarian church in which several people died made her realise that she didn't want to raise her children there. And she ended up in Leeds, where she has been based since 2009. Johanna reveals why New Zealand is like being trapped in a beautiful birdcage and why she's had an ambivalent relationship with it. We talk about the relationships we foster through Facebook and how in childhood she thought she would one day be working in the area of human rights. She has, though, tried in recent years to bring her academic work around to doing some of that. Poetry is important to Johanna, and she talks about the role of radio and podcasts, and we learn that she would rather radio to TV or film. Johanna talks about the teachers who stand out for good or ill, and she explains why she loves teaching and how it brings research to life. We talk about the importance of sharing something of yourself when you're teaching and how most learning takes place outside of the lecture theatre. Then at the end of the interview, Johanna talks about how people's first memories are often shame-related. Her memories are generally very positive. She reflects on how life is about being given opportunities, with negative experiences key to who we are. And we talk about the ways we reconstruct the past. Johanna ends the interview with a discussion of the notion of walking backwards into the future. It was such a privilege to catch up with Johanna for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews via Zoom from Leeds. My name is Chris Deasy. So it is an absolute pleasure to have Johanna Stiebert with me from Leeds this afternoon. I'm in Kent, you're in Leeds. And of course, you're one of a few interviewees, Johanna, who I've never actually met in person. But we have so many people in common that I guess we could probably have a whole hour just talking about our friends in the know, some of whom I've interviewed, others not.
Yes, we could.
And perhaps we will. So we shall see. But, you know, edit button at the ready. But do you want to say a little bit, Johanna, about what you do and where you're based?
Right. I'm based at the University of Leeds in a department of theology and religious studies. I am a professor of biblical Hebrew and Hebrew Bible. I've actually never studied religious studies. I got into it through studying Hebrew language, classical Hebrew, at Otago University in New Zealand long, long ago, and just stuck with it and have been in a number of jobs before joining the department here just over 10 years ago now.
Yeah, and there's a very common, I think, trajectory of colleagues, indeed in religious studies, who did, for example, English as a first degree and then went on to do something very different. Maybe at PhD level, they did something very specialised, which involved the Bible, and then, of course, become professor of religious studies down the line, which is never what they could have imagined in their undergraduate days all those years earlier. Sounds like you had a similar experience.
Yep, very much so. I did actually study English. I am one of those people you've just talked about. And I was in New Zealand. My mother is a New Zealander. I'd been living in New Zealand for some years by then, and needed a subject to go to Otago University that wasn't offered in my home city, which was Wellington. And so I added Hebrew just to get a living away from home allowance. And I thought I'll do this for 1 year and continue on with English, and then just grew to love it and ended up majoring in both Hebrew and English. Mm. So it was fortuitous, not at all planned.
As with most things in life, but it must be from your students' point of view, or indeed from your point of view teaching your students, fascinating, because you had a different form of assimilating everything that you've learned over the years from different disciplinary perspectives. And you must have your own very idiosyncratic way of knowledge and learning, which, as I find, even though, I mean, my background's in theology, so I haven't moved that far in terms of what I'm doing now. But of course, I'm always aware that I'm teaching my students the kind of stuff which I was taught 25, 30 years ago, to varying degrees, but also replicating both the manner of the people who taught me and the content. So I always feel slightly fraudulent in a way, because I kind of feel I'm just channeling what I learned. And I think, well, it worked for me 25 years ago, and I'll sort of do an updated version for my students in 2020.
Yeah, no, that sounds all too familiar. Yes. Yeah. Feeling like a fraud is, I think, something that many of us would own up to. Yeah.
No, well, of course, the other thing is we were just talking before we started recording about lockdown, and particularly in the run-up to teaching online, you know, it's sometimes a way of finding creative new ways of delivering material that we have in the past. And even though the students have never been taught that particular module before, sometimes I think, gosh, I did do this a few years ago, and I really need to do something different. And then sometimes you find yourself with the same set of lecture notes, and I think, I'm going to do this one off the cuff, because I suddenly feel like I'm repeating something that I don't want to be repeated, or the audience in front of me is responding in a very different way to what worked 5 years ago. You must have had that.
I have completely revamped my teaching. I'm teaching a module at the moment on ideologies of the Hebrew Bible. And I've just made it, I think it's just the pressure of the times with, you know, the US elections and Trump standing there brandishing a Bible and the Black Lives Matter protests and the various ways the Bible has featured in both Black Lives Matter and Me Too has just made me feel quite under pressure from within to want to change my module entirely. And then with the whole format and structure changing, with everything being pre-recorded and online now, that was just yet another incentive. So yes, I very much hear what you're saying. I've completely changed everything around in terms of content and in the way I deliver the content as well.
Yeah, no, that's very laudable, because certainly there couldn't be more structural difference, seismic differences in 2020 to anything that we could have anticipated with, as you say, the elections in America, which are not yet resolved. I mean, hopefully by the time this interview goes out, there will be some clarity on that. But at the moment, although there's a clear winner, we're talking on the 16th of November, almost 2 weeks since the election, and still both sides claiming victory, and one side clearly in the ascendancy, and the other looking like it's sour grapes, if I'm honest.
Yeah, no, terrifying times. I lived in the US for 6.5 years before I came to Leeds in Tennessee. That was quite an experience teaching what I teach in a context like that, in the kind of buckle of the Bible Belt, as they often say. But I still feel, you know, great love for that part of the world, even though I know some of the attitudes that are unfolding so publicly right now that are so worrying. But I'm finding watching the elections absolutely nail-biting. And no matter how it pans out, I think there's just a lot of healing that needs to be done. It's a really, really stressful event, isn't it?
Yeah, no, and I've learned my geography may not be my strongest subject, but every 4 years I suddenly, you know, realize that I can distinguish between my Wyomings and my Wisconsins, my Marylands and my Massachusetts, because just occasionally I was listening to watching a film actually the other day called The Judd, which is set in Indiana, and just suddenly I thought, I know it's Midwest, but then on my map I was watching the whole film thinking, I don't want to stop this, but I wanted to get my map out just to see on which side, and it was actually Indiana is actually a bit further east than I was imagining. I think I was probably imagining it was somewhere where, you know, next to Nevada or something, but you know, but again, I kind of feel it's an education, but also, as you say, in terms of the way, because I've always had a very clear sense, I mean, I would always vote Democrat, but a very clear sense of where I lean. And then when you kind of see a country so deeply polarized, You think, you say healing is a word, and I think that's going to be really hard, especially if you have one side flagging up the fact that the result is a fraud. And that, I think when you get into that sort of territory and how different that is from previous generations of leaders who gracefully said, you know, I'm sad that I didn't win, but the people have spoken and I congratulate my winner and then welcome them to the White House and have the succession, that doesn't look like it's going to happen this time. And I think that's appalling.
You know, as with, to bring up another horrible topic, as with Brexit, I think when you have something that's so close, where you virtually have, you know, half the population voting one way and the other half another, there is no winning. Nobody really wins because you have the other half feeling disenfranchised, feeling sad, feeling angry. So it's going to be hard. Yeah. Of course, I want to hear it confirmed that Biden is the next president, very much so. I think just the way Trump has behaved has been so appalling. He should have to leave just for the way he's behaved, even if he did get more votes. I think it's just been so unpresidential. But yes, but it's not going to be any easier for it, given just how split the country is.
Absolutely. And you mentioned you stayed in America, but do you want to say a little bit then about your journey to where you are now? Because obviously there's New Zealand, there's Britain. It sounds like lots of other countries along the way.
Yeah, it's been all over the place. And it was kind of, it sort of had to be that way. I have a parent from each country. So my mother is a New Zealander. My father is German. My grandfathers fought on opposite sides of the Second World War. My father actually emigrated to New Zealand as a conscientious objector, met my mother there, and my older sister and I were both born there. But before I really was able to absorb the world in a way I remember, I had already moved to Germany. So all my earliest life was in a satellite town of the city of Hamburg. So I grew up in a place called Bergedorf in the 1970s. And German is my first language, great childhood. The Second World War, very much a presence because of the particular family I have. And then my parents divorced and my mother determined after some time to return to New Zealand. And my sister and I went with her, and that was in right at the end of 1980. So very formative event that for me, the return to New Zealand, learning English. I spoke some English, but you know, learning English very consciously. It was the year of the Springbok tour when New Zealand broke the Glen Eagles Agreement. That was in 1981. Very politicizing for me, especially at the age I was then. And yeah, so then I finished school in New Zealand, first degree in New Zealand, University of Otago. I've already mentioned I kind of slipped into Hebrew and then left afterwards I was at that point going to leave university altogether. My real love was really human rights and journalism. Completely failed at getting any kind of career started in either one of those areas, but came to England. I was in love with someone who was living in England by then, in Leeds actually, as it happens. And really because I failed at getting any great jobs as I had hoped I would, I continued to study, went to Cambridge, got a Cambridge Commonwealth bursary to go to Cambridge, and took a 2-year degree there in Biblical Hebrew. That was a mixed experience for me. Great teaching, really appreciated the learning I received there, but found the wider environment quite stifling. So when it came to doing a PhD, I decided to leave Cambridge and go to Glasgow. And Glasgow was for me just the next best thing to heaven, really. It's just the happiest time, wonderful place. Studied with the wonderful Bob Carroll up there, who is a bit of a maverick in Hebrew Bible. And then by then I was sort of so qualified, I wasn't really up to doing much else rather than teach what I'd been taught all these years. And was lucky to get a job in a place that was then called St. Martin's College in Lancaster. It's now the University of Cumbria. And that was a great place to start teaching. It was not too intimidating, lovely colleagues, but it also wasn't really for me. It was, after Glasgow, a bit quiet, a bit bleak. And I think if I'd gone there any other time in my life, I now really enjoy returning to Lancaster. But at that time, it all felt like just not Glasgow and just not a place I wanted to be. And I felt a real yearning to just be in a vibrant city again or to have an adventure of some sort. So I signed up for VSO, Volunteer Service Overseas, because I, again, had failed in getting jobs I'd applied for. There were very few at the time, and the two I applied for, I didn't get. So I thought, I'll teach English as a second language. I did a course in teaching English as a second language. I was on my way to Madagascar. And then an ad appeared for teaching Hebrew Bible at the University of Botswana. And I applied and got it. So I ended up going there instead. And that kind of fulfilled what I was looking for at the time, an exotic setting and adventure. And it also enabled me to stick with my subject, which I really loved, very much enjoyed still, as I do to this day, studying ancient Hebrew texts. And then I spent 3 years at the University of Botswana, transformative time, absolutely wonderful. I think every white person should have the experience of being an outsider in the way I was there. It was a really positive, life-affirming, fabulous experience to go somewhere that I really knew nothing about and learn about my subject because it was interpreted there in such a very different way. And I had the huge fortune of teaching alongside Musa Dube, who's quite a celebrity in our field. She's a feminist post-colonial scholar of the New Testament. And she became a great mentor to me, got me into really seeing my subject as important and relevant. I'd always found it wonderful to immerse myself in my subject because it was arcane and I enjoyed sort of untangling difficult texts, that kind of thing. But what I learned in Botswana through people like Musa was just how important it was that it could actually do the kinds of human rights things that I had always wanted to do. I was there at the height of the HIV/AIDS pandemic, which was centered in Botswana. And it was thanks to Musa that I became involved in interpreting the Bible from perspectives that accommodated HIV/AIDS and to try and address the crisis. And that was really quite extraordinary. So three really, really important years for me there. But then I decided that it was time to leave, not because I didn't like it, I did, but as an expatriate, I couldn't ever be made permanent there. And so I sought out to go to the US. I traveled through the US, I had brief stopovers there, usually traveling between Germany and New Zealand. But I really wanted the experience of living there for longer and teaching there and going to the big conferences I'd heard about and that kind of thing. So I applied for jobs and got one at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, and again moved to a place not knowing much about it. It was very different from Botswana, is probably one way to put it. And again, it was learning about my subject and how it was very much shaped by the environment in which I was teaching and in which it was read. Really fascinating. I didn't really know much about Southern Baptism and conservative, more fundamentalist Christianity, not having had a Christian upbringing at all. And so I had 6.5 fabulous years there, got married there, had 2 children there. And then there was an awful shooting when I was pregnant with my younger child in a Unitarian church where I had given several talks. And a right-wing crazy person with a legally acquired machine gun hidden in a guitar case entered this Unitarian church and started gunning into the crowd. Many people I knew were there, and several were killed until he was wrestled to the ground. And when that happened, I made the move instantly. I was going to leave the US. For me, the gun laws and the car dependency really gave me pause for staying and especially raising children there. And so I led a semester at the University of Swansea, taking a group of students across there. And while there, I saw the ad for the job in Leeds, applied, and was very lucky to get it. So I've been here ever since 2009. So since my children were 1 and 3. So they have Yorkshire accents and live with me just outside of Leeds now. So that's the journey. It's been kind of all over the place, really.
Well, it's an amazing journey. I mean, actually, it's funny because of all the places there, the one that I have been to, which is, well, I've been to Glasgow, but St. Martin's Lancaster was the first ever conference I went to. And that was the BASR conference in 1996. And I've been to Lancaster a couple of times since. But what a journey. I mean, those sort of experiences, I mean, obviously the impact on your personal life is very obvious from what you've said, but also I'm guessing in terms of research as well. I mean, to have those sort of experiences, I mean, a lot of the world I see, and I'm not necessarily happy with this, is from a textbook or from the media. You know, I know lots about the American elections, but that because I follow it quite assiduously, but and I have many American friends, but that's not the same as, you know, primary engagement and knowing the topography of the place. But it sounds like you've had a really big insight, which has actually been transformative for good or ill in so much of your life.
It's been a big insight, but I still did not call that Trump would win the election. So even for being there all that time, and even though I had met plenty of people who, you know, would be natural Trump supporters, one might say, and Tennessee always has a strong Republican majority, even though I had, you know, 6.5 years of living there, I didn't call that Trump would win. I still remember myself saying, oh, this happens at every election. Some nut job gets put up and, you know, then they go and that's it. And so, you know, even inside knowledge of sorts doesn't always mean that you have a better understanding or ability to see it all coming.
No, and there was a time, I think it was a Christmas party we had here at Kent in, it must have been 2015, December 2015, when Trump was in the news, but and various BBC correspondents were asked, which candidate do you think is going to win? And a few of them thought that it would be Jeb Bush, and a few of them thought it might be Ted Cruz. I'm you know, trying to remember all these names from all those years ago, but not a single one thought it would be Trump. And then one correspondent made this point, which I thought was very wise. He thought Trump is going to completely obliterate turn the Republican Party upside down. But he wasn't a natural Republican. He'd even supported Hillary Clinton in her failed 2008 bid, as I recall. And it was thought that therefore he'll pave the way for Hillary. So he was like, destroy the Republicans and she's bound to win. And of course, the outcome then was so different. I mean, it was just the most remarkable thing. Where, you know, we've often had in the UK people who are like celebrities standing for Parliament. And they very rarely win. Even people like Arthur Scargill or Esther Ranson, who are well-known people, you know, when it comes to the ballot box, they people often vote along party lines, that kind of thing. In America, Warren Beatty some years ago in about 98 said he was interested in becoming president. And I thought, oh, everyone has heard of Warren Beatty and he's played the presidential type roles like Bulworth in his films. You know, surely he must be in with a chance, not a chance of it. So Trump completely came from nowhere from my perspective. So that is interesting that with your insights, you didn't see it happening either.
No, yeah. I was glad I wasn't there anymore when he did. I feel very, very sorry for the many people I know who are just finding it so painful. And just to watch, you know, a place that I remember in many ways so fondly, just, you know, become so fraught and violent and the gulf between rich and poor widen more and more and more. It is very, very painful.
Yeah. And in terms of growing up, for example, in New Zealand, which probably feels light years away in many, certainly in terms of where you, in many places you've been, you've had a fascinating journey along geographical and indeed, I guess, ideological lines in terms of what you've outlined, in terms of what you experienced in America. But what do you remember from growing up? I don't know how old you were when you left New Zealand.
So I returned to New Zealand when I was 11.
Right.
And then lived there until the conclusion of my first degree. So I would have been about 23, I think, when I left. So I moved to New Zealand as a, you know, having with my earliest memories all lying in Germany. And I just remember it as being so beautiful. I still find every time I go back, which I do regularly, my mother lives there. And it's been since 2015, since I was there. I was supposed to go this year, but with the pandemic falling on us, it didn't happen. But I still am always struck when I return at just how beautiful it is. And I always have this pattern. I go back to New Zealand and I think, why did I ever leave? And there is no place more beautiful. And I really must return and stay here forever. And then after about 3 weeks, I know why I left, and I find it quite confining. And it's almost like being trapped in this beautiful birdcage, but it still feels a bit imprisoned for me. And I just realize that for all the things I really love about it, and for all the very many happy memories I have of New Zealand, that it's just not for me right now, which doesn't mean I won't ever return for good, but I just don't see that on my horizon yet.
It's like that notion, isn't it, of a perfect holiday? Because I deal with this with the students, because I'm teaching a course on death and the afterlife, and we're imagining what heaven would look like. And I guess for a lot of people, it's like the best holiday that never ends. But would you want a holiday not to end? Because otherwise it wouldn't be a holiday. And I think of the Shirley Valentine analogy, but also, you know, from experience, you know, holidays can be great, but you know, no part of life is without its casualties and its compromises. And, you know, the idea of, I mean, unless you're on a holiday by yourself and you're happy in your own company, the idea that you'll make a holiday last forever and it'll be eternally bliss seems so remote that I can imagine that New Zealand is an amazing place. But I can also see how you need to spread your wings.
It's not just that, though. It's also that New Zealand actually does have an awful lot of social problems. I mean, I was really struck on returning in 2015, and I took my children with me, and they went to school there. And when you're in a school, they just went to the local school. You come across a whole cross-section of different peoples, don't you? And I was just so struck by the amount of poverty, you know, the amount of kids who, you know, clearly weren't eating well and who were living this, you know, impoverished life. The domestic violence rates in New Zealand are unbelievable. The racial tensions, you know, it's sometimes depicted as this paradise and nothing like Australia, and everything went so smoothly with the Maori people. That's rubbish. And in a way, when you're in a place that's on the one hand so beautiful, and on the other, you become aware of these things that are gravely wrong with it, it hits you in the eye so much harder. I mean, I'm aware of that every time I go now. So it's not just a holiday feeling for me at all.
Yeah.
I'm very well aware of the things about it that are really quite problematic. And of the misrepresentation of New Zealand sometimes. I'm very used to hearing, oh, it's just a paradise on earth. It isn't.
Yeah, and I mean, a similar kind of relationship with parts of Wales, because I studied in Lampeter, which is a long, long way away from here. And in many respects, it was like a perfect place to go, because it was unspoiled, it was countryside, no distractions, you know, most people didn't have cars, so sort of you'd stay there for the whole term. Very different to my experience with students who come and go all the time. You know, once we arrived in the first week of October, we'd stay till Christmas and so on. And in that sense, good communities were built up. But also, I think it's also taken me many decades to come to terms with a place that in a way is not representative of the world outside. And you kind of, and when you've had so much of your, a bit like the Truman Show, I suppose, but when you sort of grow up in one place, and you don't really know, apart from going to conferences like at St. Martin's Lancaster, of the world outside of that, I think sometimes you need to just take time out. And it was about 15 or more years before I could even go back to the place, because it had done me a lot of good, but also I think it also held me back at the same time that it advanced me. And that's not so much Lampeter's problem, it's my problem because of my engagement with the place. But I think that we all have ambivalent relationships with our pasts, sometimes with good reason, and it's how we find a way through that. And it sounds as though you've had so many different places to draw on, so many different experiences, that when, you know, you do make your next move or your final move or retire, when if that eventually comes, you'll make an informed decision rather than a rash decision. And it sounds like you at least know what the options are.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever made a rash decision. I've made, you know, some very quick decisions. I mean, in terms of moving, I really did make that decision of leaving the US very quickly. That was it. That was, you know, I was going to be taking up the next job. Going to Botswana, I just made that decision. As soon as I was offered the job, I didn't even read the contract or bother to find out much about the place first. So I can make big decisions quite quickly, but they're usually driven by something that I feel very sure about wanting to get out of the experience.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think the other thing with New Zealand is that because I moved there, well, I mean, I know I was born there, but because I moved there when I was older, there was never quite that feeling of fully belonging there either, as much as I absolutely, truly love the place. And it was quite difficult being German and moving there with a German accent with, you know, people in New Zealand. When I arrived there, the children that I was surrounded by, all they knew about Germany really was Nazis. And it was a time of, you know, shows like Hogan's Heroes and so on. And it was really quite difficult to be constantly kind of labeled a Nazi and have your accent mimicked. And so it wasn't all so smooth and easy and wonderful. And it's the nostalgia is there, but it was also quite difficult. And I remember finding it difficult having the war depicted in these very clear-cut terms, when I knew very well that my German family were not Nazis by any means. They were, you know, card-carrying socialists before the Socialist Party was banned. And I knew how traumatized they all were by the war and how those were stories that just never featured in the context in New Zealand when the war was told about. And I still really struggle when I'm here and we have Veterans Day and poppies and so on, that it's very much this kind of one group who are heroes and, you know, the greatest generation and so on. And the complete silencing of the people who just happen to be born elsewhere and who also just went and put on a uniform and set off, like my grandfather, who joined the war right at the end when Hitler sent absolutely everybody. Until then, he had worked for the fire brigade. And then right at the end, when Hitler was sending 15-year-old boys, my grandfather was also sent to the Russian front and never came back. You know, he survived the war and his appendix burst in a Russian camp and he died horribly. But you're somehow not allowed to mourn your dead if you were on the German side. And I find some of those things that are so wrapped up with the stories I was raised with and that I very much feel a part of me, they're difficult, yeah. And they make some of the experiences I had in other places here and in New Zealand a bit more complicated and make the sense of belonging a bit less likely for me to.
And are you in touch with a lot of people from that part of your past as well? I guess through things like social media, it's very easy if you really wanted to. But is that something that you've been comfortable or able to do? Did you have enough sort of friends from that part of your life who've stayed with you?
Yeah, I've just always been that sort of person. I think because I went, you know, when I moved to from New Zealand to England, I went on my own. And then when I moved to Botswana, I went on my own, and then to the US on my own. So I've made some really big moves on my own. And everywhere I've been, I've sort of tried to hold on to the connections I left behind and to establish new ones. I always had this thing. I would throw big parties wherever I went and would just make it, you know, about Johanna's party, so that I would very quickly build up big social networks wherever I moved to. And yes, I have, you know, through Facebook, I cull it every now and then to sort of ensure that it's people that, you know, I really do feel genuinely close to. But yes, I hold on to my friends. I still write a lot of letters and emails and have social media and all of that. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, the last few years for me, very interesting, because I think Jane was, we have a mutual friend in Jane Hornsby, who's one of my first Facebook friends, because prior to about 2017, I never used it. And yet I had all these friends from my past, my school, but particularly my university, that I was kind of desperate to reconnect with. And I now have done. And in many cases, that's been a very balancing kind of thing, because sometimes you sort of realize that some people haven't changed. Sometimes you think, gosh, I'm friends with some of the people who were more peripheral friends, and some of the central friends are no longer really there. And that also makes you look back and you sometimes think, actually, maybe that is more like who they were, that they were your best friends, but they were only your best friends when they were with you, when you were down the pub or something. And that, you know, outside of that time, they sort of flitted in and out. So it's made me reassess, in actually, I think, on the whole, very positive ways, my past. And some, it took me a long while to feel that I was ready to do that, because, you know, suddenly when you have people Facebooking, friending you, when you have had nothing to do with them for 20 years, you just think, whoa, you know, am I ready to let you into my life? But once they're in, I'm thinking, you know, they're staying. They're not going anywhere. So it sounds like something very similar with you.
It does. Yeah. No, I mean, sometimes I get really fed up with Facebook and think I should get off this. And especially when you hear all that stuff about, you know, algorithms and, you know, I regularly think, oh, let's be done with it. And it's really more of a headache. And there are people on there who irritate me, you know, yeah, stuff like that. So I regularly have a real downer on Facebook, but it has proved to keep me connected to people I would otherwise lose touch with. And yes, funny things happen that people I may not ever have been that close to, I now know more about than people I feel much closer to, but they're not on Facebook. And I'm not so good at writing letters as I once was. Life gets too busy sometimes. But all up, I think it's got more of a positive bearing on my life than a negative one. So, I'll keep it going.
Absolutely. No, well, please do. Because I was just thinking as well that, you know, that one of the questions that I would have asked you afterwards, but I'll bring it forward, is about whether you could ever have imagined from childhood that you'd be doing the things that you are now. And it just, and I'm guessing the answer is probably no, but it's an interesting question in terms of also like the two-way dialogue there of what would you say to your younger self? What would your younger self say to you, to your present self in terms of what you've done in your life and career?
I feel really happy where I am now. And I think my younger self would be happy with, for the most part. I think one reason for that is, I didn't do the things I thought I would do. I always thought I would be working in, you know, sort of human rights. You know, I was passionate about human rights from a really pretty young age. Like I said before, the Springbok tour was a really big influence on me when I was just 11. And apartheid and, you know, the anti-apartheid movement was really big for me. And I was a founding member of the Kanak Action Support Group for Independence of New Caledonia when I was about 14, 15, and Amnesty International. I've been a member of that for a long, long time. And so really my plan was to be a foreign affairs correspondent or someone working in the area of human rights. And I think my younger self would see me as a bit of a loser for not going that way. But in my defense, says older Johanna now, is I've kind of tried very hard, especially in recent years, to bring my academic work around to doing some of that. So some of the work I've been doing most recently has been on gender-based violence, sort of creating projects where the Bible is read in ways to open conversations about gender-based violence and rape culture. I've worked on another project with my wonderful colleague, Adrian van Klinken, with LGBT refugees in Kenya. And that's been very satisfying. So I've kind of tried to stay true to some of that, to keep that in my life, working with refugees, against the death penalty while I was in Tennessee. So I've tried that. I wish I had more time for that and I could always do more. But I think my younger self would say, oh, I'm all right, maybe not very cool. but some compromises, but all right.
Mm-hmm. No, and do you have like a go-to thing, whether it's music or film or something, or reading something from childhood, whether it was Germany or New Zealand, something that perhaps that still connects you to those days? I mean, in my case, it was always the music charts, the sort of obsessive listening to what was in the top 40 every Sunday, and that was sort of the thing that we talked about in the classroom.
I did that too. Those programs were great, where you really had to wait, didn't you? And every week there was this kind of real tension about who was going to be the number one. And I did too. And music was enormously important to me for so long, right up until Botswana. And then I was burgled twice in quick succession and twice had my music collection stolen. And I've never really recovered. And now I'm much more of a listener to radio and podcasts and kind of spoken things rather than music. Yeah. No, poetry is a steady for me. I like poetry. I find that incredibly relaxing, sometimes to sit down and just read some beautiful language. Walking, I've always been a great walker. I have a dog now and I take my dog for walks every day. I try to go hiking with some regularity. So that's another thing. And reading, I'm a keen reader of fiction and newspapers. So Yeah, all of those things.
Yeah, no. And I think that in life, a really good balanced life is one where you can do all these things together. Because, you know, I sometimes find that in a perfect day, you know, like today, I've been marking essays today, and I actually got more done because my day is quite well structured, obviously, meeting you this afternoon. And yet, just the little things, like the 15-minute journey into work and listening to some music tapes, that kind of thing. And it does everything that hangs together well. And I think a perfect life is one where you do all the important things, but you don't do. I mean, it's like, you know, alcohol is a wonderful thing, but you couldn't drink it all day. You couldn't drink it in the morning. But if you have a right in the evening and you spend the day looking forward to that moment, that perfect beer or glass of wine, then everything else is recalibrated.
Couldn't agree more. I'm totally with you on that.
Yeah. And what about things that we mentioned, like music? I mean, you mentioned, you know, the radio, but are there particular sounds? I mean, I don't know much about New Zealand radio, but do you find that over the years that there's a particular type of music that you gravitate towards, or particular type of style of radio? Because I've been a music radio person, but also somebody who is a very big news and political type person. And it's straddling that line.
That's me too. And, you know, so I mean, Radio 4 is, I tend to have that on even all night. I find if I can't sleep and wake up, I've got something to listen to. The World Service, which I've listened to for so long in all the different places I've lived. And when I'm sleepy, I just fall asleep to it, be it the shipping forecast or whatever. So Radio 4 is quite a big presence, but it's podcasts now. I listen to a hell of a lot of podcasts when I have the time. And they're very varied. Again, like I said before, very little music. When I did listen to music, jazz, I really loved jazz, Earl Klug and Coltrane. And, you know, I really, really used to love listening to that. And I still do when it's on. I think, why don't I listen to this all the time? I like some African music, Brenda Fassie. Still, that would be one of my desert island discs, I think. But like I said before, I just, for whatever reason, don't listen to music as much as I used to. And so now I resort to podcasts much more. So I listen to Americast and Newscast and Bad People, which is about serial killers and things like that. I find that a really fascinating one. That's a kind of time out thing to listen to. Yes. Yeah, the spoken word is really important to me. More than visual media. I mean, you say you like to see films. And again, that was in parts of my life terribly important to me. But I never go to the cinema now. And I would far more readily go and listen to something on the radio than to watch something on television. Mm. Just how I am. I've always been very auditory like that.
No, that's interesting, because no, in my case film was something much later, because I grew up with radio and that has never gone away. So podcast is actually perfect, because it's like a way of doing your own radio show, but without having the, you know, the career in radio with all the resources that would be required there. So spoken word is important, but it's interesting that in my case the film interest is something that came later. But it's an interesting balance, because it's sort of like because I'm not interested in music of today, which is what my parents always used to say when I was growing up. They say, oh, it was much better in our day. And of course, you know, as somebody who grew up with all the, you know, listened to the charts in the early 80s, you know, now I look back and think, oh, that was the golden age, when the very time my parents had no time for any of that. But now I've got young children who know more about contemporary music than I do, and I've got no interest, and I think it was better in our day. And I realized the cycle repeats itself. My parents, who, you know, who are still alive, you know, must be laughing in some way, because they must have seen that trajectory a few decades before I did.
Yeah No, it's funny, I tend to listen to the kind of music they listened to that was sort of playing in the house when I was little. They loved Joan Baez and Bob Dylan, and they listen to a lot of jazz as well. And that's very much the music I like too. Yeah. So yes, I've been regressive, if anything.
No, and I found I did that at university to a large extent, of listening to the sort of music that my parents were into. And that was quite liberating in many respects, because it was kind of, you know, having your own music background, your own heritage, but also being very aware of the antecedents to that, and sort of following your parents sort of path through, and actually really appreciating that, and actually sort of seeing that my interest in music had come from them, and it was I really bought into their way of looking at things, and I completely subscribed to it. And I'd be listening to lots of sort of 80s stuff, alongside Everly Brothers, Buddy Holly, Lonnie Donegan, and it was an interesting eclectic mix. And it also meant that in the school playground, you know, I knew a little bit more. You know, I didn't know as much about things today, but I could always go back a bit further and talk about the charts of, you know, 1969 or something before I was born, and suddenly something would connect along the way, and it just kind of felt that that was my niche. You know, and I subscribe to that, and I think to an extent still do. But what about things like teachers who inspired you, whether at university or at school? Are there any particular names or, you know, particular classes that stand out?
Oh, so many. I've had great teachers. I've had absolutely wonderful teachers, and one horrible teacher who also really stands out in Germany, a really pompous woman who had a doctorate, and she always insisted on the Frau Doktor. And she was horrible and damaging. But for the most part, I have had absolutely wonderful teachers, which early on was just as well, because I went to a German primary school for 4 years. You start when you're six and you go to primary school for 4 years in Germany. And you have one teacher for everything for 4 years. So luckily, I had a really good one, who, because my older sister, rather, is exactly 4 years older than me, had been taught by my sister for 4 years continuously before she took on my class. So she was a huge presence in our lives for 8 solid years. Frau Ebel, absolutely fabulous, really, really wonderful. And then high school in Germany, where I was only for a year and a half, was not so great. And then I moved to New Zealand and had some wonderful teachers, especially in my first high school, which was a really experimental high school. It had a terrible reputation. It was a city high school. It was the only high school that had no zoning, so it accepted everybody from all over. Its principal at the time was a man called Turoa Royal, who was a man from an army background, a Maori elder. And he was absolutely wonderful. And he just turned that school around, and it was full of really idealistic, hip teachers, and all sorts of things happened in that school. There was a bilingual class. So Maori rights were still, they really accelerated with the aforementioned Springbok tour, but it wasn't fashionable yet to learn Maori, but he was turning that around in this school. There was a whānau unit, which was much more family-based learning. There was a unit for the deaf, and it was just a wonderful school. I absolutely loved it. And I know my mum was told not to send me there, because the feeling was that for an academic child, to send a child to a school with such a terrible reputation. And it was the absolute making of me. And I had some fabulous teachers there, and most fondly remembered is my English teacher, who was a woman called Nola Fox, and she was very elderly. She was really close to retirement, and she should have been an actress. And when she read aloud poetry or bits of drama, I still hear her voice, and she was immensely inspiring. And that's in part, I think, where my love of English literature came from, which is what I continue to study at university. I had a year at the New Zealand Correspondence School, because I went back to Germany to live with my father for a year. And that was wonderful. It's amazing how close you can become to a person you never actually meet face to face. But back then, it was all through tapes. So I would record tapes of conversations. My teachers recorded tapes, and I had these sets, and I did everything, you know, in writing. And I got some really great teaching there. My history teacher, whose name shamefully I don't remember, but I do remember really loving history. And then my final year of school, I was in Dunedin at Logan Park High School. And again, some absolutely outstanding teachers, especially in classical studies, Ms. Heath, and in art history, Ms. Dudney. And for my elective in Amnesty International, Mr. Enright. Loads of wonderful teachers I could mention. And then at university, I wouldn't have stayed so long if it hadn't been for the great teachers there, very many. Judith McKinley, my first Hebrew teacher, the only woman who's ever taught me in biblical studies. She was great. And then in Cambridge, several really eccentric and wonderful people like John Emerton and Geoffrey Kahn. Ah, such a genius. And then my PhD supervisor, Bob Carroll, absolutely wonderful man, and we got along so well. He was really fun and challenging. So I've had no shortage of absolutely great teachers. I could have a whole podcast just about them.
No, it sounds it, because if you're anything like me, sometimes you'll be in the midst of teaching and you'll suddenly realize that you are channeling somebody from your past, and you realize that the way that you teach, I guess I do it with broadcasters as well, like people on the radio who I grew up with, and I'm very aware of it. And I sometimes think if they were here now, and in some cases, they are still around and I still meet them occasionally, maybe not in recent years, but just sometimes you think, gosh, you know, I owe my career really to these people because they inspired me. They made me want to do this. And I've taken bits of them into my own teaching, which is kind of, I guess, normal, but also feels a bit surreal sometimes.
Yeah, no, it's funny you should say that. No, I absolutely love teaching. I know a lot of academics would rather do only research. I absolutely love teaching. It brings research, which I also care about, very much to life. And sometimes, yes, as you say, you do have this feeling of passing something on that's been handed to you. And when it works, there's no high like it, is there? But I sometimes have out-of-body experiences and think, how does that make sense to anybody? It doesn't make sense to you, or where I realize I've just been really boring. So that I still have that as well. I don't think I've cracked it completely, but it is really fun. You never know what to expect. That's part of the joy of it. You can be really well prepared, have a lecture where you know what you're going to say, and just because of what's in the room, it doesn't work, or you decide to do something completely different on the spur of the moment, and it's a good idea. Yeah, so it's really enjoyable. The teaching is a great joy.
Absolutely, no, I completely agree. A script, sometimes a lecture note or lecture set of notes is sometimes a means to an end, not the end. Or it's there when everything falls apart, or there's silence in the room, but you still need to get through the script. But it's the way that you get through it that is the exciting bit. And if you have a circuitous journey, but you still cover everything that you wanted to, then it's a good lecture rather than just reading something out without, which is why I suppose teaching online is curious, because I'm quite enjoying sitting in my office doing it, but it's also without an audience. And that's also an interesting experience stroke skill.
Yeah, no, I sort of feel I'm learning a lot, and it's wonderful sort of having a challenge. It makes you very alert, doesn't it, when you set this new set of problems and you've got to find a way to teach differently and still be enthusiastic and, you know, convey your material and figure out the things you can do with the technology. All of that's been quite enjoyable in some ways, quite satisfying. I've also loved just teaching in different places. I still have memories of when I first arrived in Botswana, and I remember I was terrified, and I had this classroom and it was very basic. There was just a blackboard on the wall and it was steaming hot and all the windows were open. And I was standing there probably very red faced. And I still remember my first class being absolutely terrified. And because I was nervous, I gabbled on and I ran through my material, bolted through it, and finished way ahead of when I thought I would finish, and found myself standing there with, you know, the clock still saying there was about 10 minutes left. So I thought, what do I do? At which point I did what I should have done at the beginning. And I said, are there any questions? And I, you know, and just hand went up, and a very big woman was sitting there, and she just said, who are you? And are you married? I just thought, but it taught me a really important lesson that it's, you know, just as I was curious about them, they were curious about me, and that you really need to share something of yourself as well. And I learned, I hope, to do that a whole lot better.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting journey, because you are right, because when you start teaching, it's very easy. Your very first lecture ever, you have too much material and you just want to read it out, and you speak very quickly, like at conferences. I've been at conferences, we've all done it, where you think you've got an hour and you only got half an hour, so you then speak really quickly to get it all done. But it should never be, and it never is about the content. The teachers I remember from school were in some cases those who did not stick to the curriculum. And it's easy to say that now, because I can look back and know something of what, you know, a curriculum is, to know that some of the best teachers in school were those who deviated from it. And in some respects, that probably made them quite bad teachers, but they inspired us. And the teachers who did stick to the curriculum were often deemed as boring. They were doing their job and often no doubt prepared very well for it. So perceptions do count, but you are right that you are sometimes thinking that other students listening to every word that you're saying, or are they really thinking, what is he wearing or what's he up to? what sort of life does he lead? You know,
how much do you really learn in terms of, you know, what you take in from a lecture? I think really the learning happens outside of the lecture. You know, it's like with children. I mean, really, you send your kids to school so they get socialized and learn that the world is about more than just home life. But most of the learning really happens in the kind of day to day, doesn't it? And I think a good teacher is somebody who just really gets you inspired and enthused about going and finding out things for yourself. It's not about, you know, taking accurate notes and what they actually say so much. So I console myself for
adequately. Well, no, you are right, because my sense of being at school sometimes was that it felt like a school for discipline, in the sense that it was like, do the right things, walk on the right side of the corridor, put your hand up, address the teacher as sir or miss. I mean, how crazy, you know, and some teachers hated that. When they'd read the register, you'd say, yes, miss, if you were there. And she said, I'm married, you know, but it was all those conventions and we had to adhere to them. And it's only now when I can see education as something that's very creative, very sort of originistic, not Augustinian perhaps, but the sort of idea that it is about learning and relearning and it's about growth and character growth. Whereas at school, it felt sometimes that we were there almost, you know, so, you know, if you had a successful day at school, it meant you weren't told off. Now, looking back, that's a very odd way. That's a very strange form of education to me.
Yeah, so in earlier school, I had some of those experiences, but I have to say I went to really fantastic high schools and really felt very, very encouraged there. I mean, I still remember when I was 14, 1984, that was the, 1985, sorry, the commemoration of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. And like I said, I was very political and I had decided together with my friend that we would try and have a commemorative event to mark this. And my wonderful principal, Tuaroa Royal, permitted that the whole school, you know, together with other schools, we wrote to other principals as well, gathered in the middle of Wellington and we had a minute's silence and we all got to go off school to do this. And we had a delegation come over from Japan, whom he encouraged me to invite, and we got a community peace prize, and he got all of that, you know, he encouraged us, and you know, here I was 14, 15, and had this idea, and he let me run with it, and nurtured it, and made it happen, so I was incredibly fortunate to have these kinds of experiences, so my memories of high school were not at all of being sort of told to address people as sir or miss, and you know, I think I enjoyed an awful lot of freedom and really, really enjoyed school.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and that's exactly what I did, particularly at university. That's when that sort of thriving sort of happened. But just a few more questions, Johanna, as we start to wrap up. It's something that I probably preempt some of your answers, but would you say that your memories are predominantly positive as you survey your life and career?
Oh, it's really interesting you should ask that. I often ask people about what their first memory is, because I my PhD was in the area of shame. And I found it so interesting, just anecdotally, how often your first memory is shame related. Mine isn't. Mine is related to disappointment, to an ice block I was promised, which had snapped. And I was about 2 or 3, I guess, given where we were living at the time. But even though that's my earliest memory, I'd say the majority of my memories are very positive. Yeah. No, I think I've been really lucky in my life in all sorts of ways, with the kind of family I was born into, with the sisters I have, and that even though my parents separated, that we're a very intact family in all sorts of ways. Not an uncomplicated one. I'm not saying life has all been a joyride by any means, but I think I've always felt supported and encouraged. And I've mostly been really healthy, and you know, so I've had good friends. I just realized how lucky I am for the opportunities I've had. You know, it's I remember I had a friend in Botswana who traveled to Hamburg with me, and I remember asking him, you know, what do you want to do? Because you've never been overseas. And he said to me, no one's ever asked me that. No one's ever asked me, what do you want to do? And my whole life has been, you know, one of being allowed to make choices and to being given opportunities. And yeah, I think it would be awful if I said anything other than positive. I've been really, really lucky. And the majority of my memories are positive.
Yeah, and I guess concomitant with that is, particularly in the light of 2020 with lockdown, but is it possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences?
Yeah, absolutely, because they are key to who you are. They sometimes, you know, I think sometimes do hit up against your shortcomings. Yeah, and I mean, and nostalgia, I mean, I don't know, what is, you probably know the literal meaning of the word. Is
longing for home, I guess, yeah.
Longing for home? Yeah, I think I do. We've just moved house, and in the course of that, I've been sorting through those boxes of stuff that everybody has, which have often been full of letters and old pictures and so on. And I've been reminded of very many painful things that have happened too in the course. You can't get to the age I am, which is 51 now, and not accumulate some pretty awful things. You know, I've had cancer, I've lost people I love, you know, I've had loads of painful goodbyes just because I've moved so much and felt dislocated from people who are very dear to me. But I still like thinking back to that, and I still think back quite wistfully to some of that, because those experiences, painful as they may have been, were also very intense. They're also things that can make you feel very alive and very bonded to the people who were there for you.
No, that word wistful actually is a really important one, because I think with nostalgia, it's not always, it's easy to imagine nostalgia as all being about pleasure. But of course, it's that melancholia, is that what's fueling the nostalgia is this sense of something that we may have once had in our mind, or in actuality, a home, whether it's a physical home or a home in the mind, a sense of belonging, and the sense that we are no longer in that environment and that we are displaced. And the question is, can we recapture it? Do we want to recapture it again?
And I always loved that quote. It was Garcia Marquez or something about, you know, the past is a lie and memory has no return, and even the wildest and most tenacious love is an ephemeral truth in the end. And you know, and it's quite right. You kind of reconstruct the past when you look back at it. And I found one of the things when I was looking through some of these old letters of, you know, tenacious love, for example, is that, you know, I sometimes might remember someone as having hurt me terribly. And then when I read the letters and the letters they wrote to me, I think now how reasonable they were and how shockingly unreasonable I was. And the whole way I reflect back is rather different. And that brings unexpected nostalgia sometimes.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. Passage of time has a huge impact on that. But my very last question to you, Johanna, is, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Oh, that's really hard. I think I'm not a great planner. So I'm probably, I mean, I don't think I'm stuck in the past, but I like that image that, you know, that is sometimes used of Aboriginal people, of walking backwards into the future and taking the things that have made you and the people you who are dear to you, you're looking at them as you're heading backwards into the future. So I think I am looking back more than a looking forward, I would say, if I'm totally honest. I wish I could say I'm, you know, surging forward all the time. But no, probably I'm very attached to my past, and even to the past that predates me, really. I'm very interested in things like my grandmother and the life she had long before I was born. So yeah, a looking back person.
Well, on perfect way to end. Johanna, that was an amazing interview. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
That was fun. That was really fun. It's really nice to meet you, Chris, and I enjoyed that. Thank you.